It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a medical ethicist tells us what's involved in the life or death decision of who should be next in line to get a coronavirus vaccine. First, President Joe Biden spoke today shortly after being sworn in by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts as the 46th President of the United States.
This is America's day. This is democracy's day, a day of history and hope, of renewal and resolve. Through a crucible for the ages, America has been tested anew, and America has risen to the challenge. Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy. The people, the will of the people, has been heard. And the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
Biden spoke from the west front of the U.S. Capitol building. It's the week in Washington. We're looking at the inauguration as well as changes in political power in the U.S. Senate and day one objectives for President Biden. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch today's inauguration? What stood out to you? Did you have a moment that struck you in particular? If you didn't watch, are you planning to come back and watch later? Whether you voted for or against Biden, what were you thinking while watching it? And what do you want to see as day one priorities for the new administration? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Craig Gilbert is a political reporter and Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and JS Online. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
Now, Craig, I understand you've attended many inaugurations. This one was a harder ticket between the pandemic and all the security precautions. But you were watching it. How did what you saw today compare to years past?
Yeah, I think I've been to every inauguration since the Clinton presidency in person. I did not go to this one in person because of the pandemic and because of all the security issues. It's always a really kind of treasured event. And it's great to be there. It's great to see it up close. This one, obviously, with a unique backdrop and, you know, what we take for granted about this ritual, we didn't take for granted this time. I mean, that was really the subtext of everything that happened today, was that, you know, this was not a normal ritual, you know, unexceptional transfer of power. And everything unfolded, obviously, against the broader backdrop of the pandemic, but against the particular backdrop of the storming of the Capitol. And so that really, I think, framed the event for Joe Biden and really the overriding theme of his inaugural, which was healing and unity and, you know, kind of repairing what the country has been through.
Is that a message that you think is going to be heard by Republicans and Democrats, for that matter, in Congress? Do you think that obviously they want to grant everything? Do you see room there for unity and compromise after what we saw, especially on January 6th?
Well, I mean, on paper, it's a message that does, I think, that does is appealing for a lot of Republicans. For one thing, they're in the minority, so they're out of power. You know, they're hoping and appealing to Democrats to sort of, quote, put their money where their mouth is and work with them because the Democrats hold the power. Now, it's not a big margin of power, particularly in the Senate, but you know, there's going to be this tension and this discussion and debate going forward in this presidency over, you know, from the Republican perspective, over whether Democrats are, you know, are sincere about working together. And there's also going to be, I think, you know, for Democrats, they're going to be sitting back and watching to see whether Republicans are sincere about being a constructive minority party. So, you know, this is all so different from the ethos of what happened 4 years ago. I mean, 4 years ago, Donald Trump did talk about healing and he did talk about unity, but tonally it was very different. And, you know, these are two very different people, but also the context is entirely different.
Wisconsin's congressional delegations, past and present, some of them were at the event. Some have been commenting. Former House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin was at the inauguration. Reporters quoted him saying, quote, our institutions were tested this year and our institutions passed the test. And he also said, quote, Joe Biden is legitimately elected president of the United States, and I'm here to honor this process. Now, talk about a statement that we might usually take for granted in a normal presidential transition, Craig. A Republican, a prominent Republican, just saying that Joe Biden is legitimately elected president is actually significant.
Yeah, I mean, it feels silly in some respects to sort of treat that like a news event, because, like you said, it would be unexceptional in normal times for the party, for people in the losing party to sort of acknowledge that they lost an election and it was a legitimate election. But with the president, you know, kind of baselessly and repetitively claiming the election was stolen, you know, it put people in his party had to decide whether to kind of echo those sentiments or whether to push back against them or whether just to remain silent. And we saw people take all three of those tacks within the Republican Party. Paul Ryan, you know, a traditional Republican, former speaker, you know, not just today, but also a couple of weeks ago, you know, was on record as saying, you know, as opposing the effort to overturn the election and acknowledging the legitimacy of the election, as have some other Republicans, but not all Republicans.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at today's inauguration and other big related news in national politics. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and reactions to today's inaugural event, with your hopes or fears for the coming days, the first days of the Biden administration. What kind of policies do you want to see focused on? Are there things where you think Democrats and Republicans can come together in the White House and Congress to get things done? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Turning to Congress now, Craig, we saw some other swearings in, two now Democratic senators from Georgia and a Democratic senator from California to replace Vice President Kamala Harris. So now there's this power shift, 50-50 with the vice president as the tiebreaker. At a practical level, 50 votes plus a tiebreaker isn't enough to do everything you want to do in a Senate. What does it allow Democrats to do?
Well, there are some things the Senate can pass with a simple majority and some things that require a veto-proof majority, which is two-thirds or 67 senators. So, you know, budget bills or things that are construed as budget bills typically take just a simple majority. And some appointments take a simple majority. But a lot of legislation requires two-thirds approval. And so there are obviously real limits on what Democrats can do in both chambers, because their margin in the House, which doesn't have the filibuster, is pretty narrow. And so, you know, there are some House Democrats that represent districts that were carried by Donald Trump, Wisconsin as one of them, Ron Kind. I think there are only about a dozen Democrats that fit that description, but his district voted for Trump twice, and he's sort of styles himself as a centrist Democrat. So someone like Ron Kind may not be in exactly the same place on some issues as Wisconsin's other two Democratic House members, Mark Pocan of Madison and Gwen Moore of Milwaukee. And in the Senate, again, 50-50 deciding vote cast by the vice president. But, you know, those 50 Democratic senators include, you know, most notably Joe Manchin of West Virginia, a state that overwhelmingly voted for Donald Trump, and a few other Democrats that are, you know, are more moderate members of the party and whose states are more purple. And we may find on some issues that they kind of act in league with, you know, a handful of moderate Republicans to try to take the initiative on some issues.
We're talking about the top stories in national politics, the inauguration, and the days ahead for the Biden administration and the new look in Congress. Craig Gilbert stays with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's the week in Washington. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 if you'd like. Looking for your thoughts and reactions to the inauguration events today. What stood out to you? Were there moments that you thought were particularly significant? And now that the ceremonies are about done, what are you looking for from a Biden presidency and from Congress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and reactions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Week in Washington talk with Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at today's inauguration and what comes next. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Did you watch? What stood out to you? One thing that stood out to a lot of people, not usually, I think, the highlight of these events, the poem, a performance from the youngest poet ever to read at an inauguration. Here's a listen to 22-year-old Amanda Gorman from Los Angeles.
When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace. In the norms and notions of what just is, isn't always just is. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother, can dream of becoming president, only to find herself reciting for one.
Craig, again, you've seen some inaugurations. Did this this poem stand out to you in ways maybe that past ones haven't?
Yeah, it did. Again, I think a lot of the power of this inaugural comes from what, you know, the events we've all been living through. And this poem, obviously, was in many ways a product of what happened on January 6th. And I think it was powerful and it was hopeful. And it was the spirit and tone of the poem was, you know, everything, all the conflict and challenges that we've been living through and contending and the notion that, you know, there is still progress to be made and progress can be made. And it was hopeful and it was lyrical, I think. So the poem did stand out. The inaugural address, you know, Joe Biden is not, you know, considered the greatest orator in politics. But I do think, you know, there were some striking themes in there. And I think, you know, he did a good job of articulating and conveying the theme of, I mean, not just sort of unity and healing, but also the, you know, the political, taking on the political culture. I mean, the idea that, you know, people, we have to learn how to put ourselves in each other's shoes and see things from each other's perspective. The line that stood out to me was, politics doesn't have to be a raging fire destroying everything in its path. And I think that is something that has become truly dismaying to a lot of people in politics and a lot of Americans, is just this idea that politics has become, you know, total war. And that stood out, and his appeal to his defense of truth and his appeal to facts stood out. So it was, I think, you know, a lot of really notable elements in what sometimes is an unremarkable event, like I said, and so I think a memorable one.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Mary Beth is with us in New Berlin. Mary Beth, hi.
Hello. What I'd like from this new administration is to see a lot of work get done and very quietly.
Mary Beth, thanks a lot for bringing that up. President Trump, like him or not, he definitely liked to see himself in headlines, had a knack for getting himself there. It seemed to work for him, obviously, in the 2016 election. I've seen some people hoping to not see the U.S. president's name in the headlines quite so often, Craig.
Yeah, so we've already seen, you know, the contrast between the launching of President Biden's Twitter feed and, you know, President Trump's Twitter feed the last 4 years, you know, which was, you know, exclamation marks and caps and pretty provocative. And Joe Biden's first tweet really, I think, struck that tone that the listener was referring to, which is, you know, we got a lot of work to do and no time to waste and not a lot of drama not a lot of caps and exclamation marks. So I think there's really, you know, there's such a clear stylistic difference between Donald Trump and pretty much every other president. But I think we're seeing a stylistic difference between, you know, in sort of how Joe Biden, the tone that Joe Biden is trying to strike, and maybe even the tone and style that other Democrats who might have won the nomination, you know, would have been striking at this moment.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Katie now in Green Bay. Katie, hello.
Hi. So I feel such a great, profound sense of relief. And I appreciated Biden's calls for unity. But I think we need to realize that for many people in this country, these 4 years just haven't been about an administration that we disagree with. This is a person who is abusive, who name calls, who terrified, who caused, you know, death. And so to move on from an abusive situation doesn't mean to forget and pretend it didn't happen. You know, we need to name. And I think that Joe Biden did that. He called out the lies. He called out the white supremacy. So I think as we move forward, we need to remember this isn't just about the differences of opinions. But Donald Trump is an abuser, and he abused this nation for a long time. And that's a different kind of healing.
Katie, thanks for the call. And that reminds me of a big topic we haven't talked about yet, Craig. Speaking of the issue of accountability, impeachment. The impeachment still is sitting there. The Senate trial still awaits at a, as yet undetermined date. What are you watching for with that?
Well, so, yes. I mean, will they proceed? Presumably, we think they will. When will they proceed? Will there be new information coming to light that could influence the actions of the Senate? Will proceeding with an impeachment trial, will it, you know, conflict in any way with, you know, the business of the Biden administration? What one caller talked about, you know, getting a lot of work done and getting it done quietly. I mean, these are all kind of judgments. Some of them are tactical, but some of them are pretty significant that the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress will have to make. And then if it comes to it, you know, Republicans in the Senate will have to make their own judgments. Mitch McConnell has sort of signaled that he's not shut the door on voting to convict. Some other Republican senators likewise. And so Republicans will have their own decisions to make about how to handle that.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at today's inauguration and the first steps for the Biden administration. Back to your calls now. Norm is with us in Oneida County. Hi, Norm.
Yeah, hello. My concern is for the environment. The Trump administration opened up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska for oil drilling, and they also opened up the Tongass National Forest for mining and logging. And I'm very concerned about the environment. I'm wondering if Biden can overrule these things that Trump has done.
Norm, thanks a lot for that call. Some of those things that Norm is referring to done by various forms of presidential executive action. What are you watching for on environmental issues with Biden using the same kind of powers, Craig?
Well, President Biden has already indicated that he's going to, you know, rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, and so he's, you know, and along with that, we're going to see executive actions to roll back. I mean, there will be executive orders flying out of that office starting today to roll back Trump orders on a whole bunch of different fronts, but certainly on the environment, along with, you know, immigration and the pandemic and other areas. So, yeah, I mean, one of the things you can do as president even with a very closely divided Congress, is you can undo what your some of the things your predecessor did by executive fiat. You can't undo everything, but you can undo a lot. And then there will be other things that he'll have to try to accomplish legislatively.
Thanks for the call, Norm. Craig, in our last minute or so, what are you most curious to see what's going to happen next?
Well, I mean, I you mentioned one of them, which is, of course, you know, what happens with an impeachment trial in the Senate. I think that really truly is a wild card. You know, we're going to go through a period where we have the Senate has to affirm cabinet nominees, and we don't know whether some of those will turn out to be roadblocks or not. How the Senate functions 50-50 and what the role that, you know, I mentioned this before, but what the role that some of the more moderate Democrats and Republicans play in this. And also, you know, in a broader sense, politically, there's just sort of the whole question about how the Republican Party moves forward post-Trump and to what extent it continues to be sort of a, you know, in the thrall of Trump and to what extent Republicans, you know, try to put Trump in the rearview mirror.
We'll leave it there for now. Craig, thanks a lot for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Craig Gilbert is a political reporter and Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can follow his work at JS Online. We talked to him today for our Week in Washington, looking at today's presidential and vice presidential inauguration, as well as Biden's first day in office and changes in the U.S. Senate. Coming up after the news, a medical ethics expert joins the program to talk about how the U.S. and the world have decided who gets access to the COVID vaccine first. And tune in tonight at 6 for NPR special coverage of the White House news conference with the incoming press secretary in the Biden administration, Jen Psaki. It's the first daily briefing with reporters on the new Biden-Harris administration's agenda. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, the National Rifle Association is filing for bankruptcy reorganization in the midst of a big transition in national politics. Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at the NRA and the latest on gun control politics. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, in the midst of COVID-19 vaccine distribution, there's a big question facing policymakers at all levels. How do you decide who gets a potentially life-saving vaccine next? The U.S. vaccine program is behind the schedule laid out by federal health officials. As of late December, only about a fifth of available vaccine in the country had been used. And there have been issues about access. For example, in Milwaukee, most COVID vaccines so far have gone to young white residents, though the pandemic has disproportionately affected communities of color and older people. Same is true in the country at large, with vaccination rates for white Americans 2 to 3 times higher in some places. Wisconsin health officials decided this week to move up people 65 and older on the priority list. The health department says the decision was based on the fact that people in that age group are at risk of serious illness or death. And from a global perspective, you're way more likely to have access to a vaccine if you live in a wealthy country. You could join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about vaccine priorities. Who do you think should be at the top of the list or near the top of the list for receiving the limited supply of coronavirus vaccines? Are you an essential worker yourself? Have you received one? Do you know where you are on the list? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nicole Hassoun is a professor of philosophy at Binghamton University in New York and a visiting scholar at Cornell University. She's the director of Global Health Impact, an organization that seeks to expand healthcare access for the poor. Her latest book is Global Health Impact, Extending Access to Essential Medicines. Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Well, we've had this rollout not going on very long now with vaccines. What stands out to you when it comes to the way at the national and state levels we've prioritized who gets vaccines first and next?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're doing a lot better than some countries. We have distributed, I think, about 3 or 4 vaccines per 100 people in our population, and it's fairly equitably distributed between states. But there's a long way to go. There's countries like Israel that have already gotten 30 doses for every 100 people out there. Some of the problems that we've been facing are, you know, poor coordination between federal governments and states, some poor guidance given in different states. But one of the issues is that the manufacturing of vaccines is really difficult. So you don't just need the principal ingredients, but you need things like glass vials, rubber stoppers, the lipids and other components that go into those. And we have to get those vaccines to people. So there's the cold chain that needs to be in place. The kind of vaccines we have in the US are these mRNA vaccines. They're a new technology. We're creating new manufacturing systems to create them. Those are supposed to be easier, but then the resulting vaccines are very much more difficult to distribute, especially Pfizer's, which requires this ultra cold storage. So getting it to rural areas, for instance, is pretty difficult. I think there's some geopolitics that are also playing a role. So there's a competition globally for this vaccine. And so Pfizer, for instance, said to the EU recently, we're not going to be able to provide you with the doses we promised. Also, you know, even in the US, it seems like that's maybe not happening quite as quickly as everybody had hoped. Countries are restricting the exports of vaccines. They're trying to prioritize their populations first. Even the US, you know, had an executive order to try to constrain that vaccine distribution. So I guess I'd like to see, you know, I would like to see things done a little bit differently. I'd love to see more cooperation and collaboration and funding into that manufacturing system that would support efforts globally to distribute the vaccines as well as, you know, in our area.
Yeah, before we key in on kind of local decisions on who to prioritize first, I want to pursue that point about internationally. What are you seeing happening with especially lower income countries around the world and their ability to get and distribute vaccines?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, we talk about cold chain being difficult here in parts of, you know, in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, 28% of facilities lack consistent electricity supply. So even having refrigeration is extremely difficult, and getting people to those health centers, you know, it can take a full day's travel to get someone to a health center to get vaccinated. And I think one of the most important things we should do is put kind of a basic health system in place for everyone. We need to fund public health. We need to do it in this country. But globally, if we don't prepare well for the next pandemic, which is likely going to be much worse than this one, then I think we're really in a bad place. We need to be able to vaccinate people much more quickly than we are. There's some efforts to do this. So there's something called the COVAX initiative, which is a collaboration of, you know, countries coming together. Unfortunately, the United States hasn't joined COVAX, but they've come together to accelerate the manufacture and distribution of vaccines globally and aim to help 20% of the global population get the vaccine quickly. And I could definitely talk about some more of the, you know, the problems that we have in getting the vaccines to people in poor countries, if you'd like.
But briefly, before we move on to how we distribute in the United States, what other roadblocks are there? Surmountable, hopefully, roadblocks are there.
For sure. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not, people do get vaccinated. So I think UNICEF is providing on a regular basis vaccines for about half the world's children. But there's big gaps too. So not only, you know, in terms of health facilities and cold chain supplies and distribution networks and the provision of the vaccines themselves, but even health workers, right? There's kind of a global competition for healthcare personnel, and we need to have people who can administer the vaccine. So you see things like the Global Polio Eradication Initiative, effectively building a second shadow national health system in India of 900,000 workers. What we should be doing is sustaining basic health services and infrastructure in place for everyone, which would allow us to overcome diseases like polio and, you know, other diseases like, you know, COVID that are threatening people.
Talking to Nicole Hassoun from Binghamton University, talking about the ethics of vaccine distribution and priorities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Given that we don't have enough vaccines at this point and we won't for a while to vaccinate everybody, who do you think should be at the top of the list or next on the list after that first round? you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and with your questions, 800-642-1234. Well, with that question of how the U.S. and state governments decide who goes next, Wisconsin started, as many states did, with frontline health workers and older people, and that older age just got lowered to 65 now. I want to listen to Deputy Secretary of the State Health Services Department, Julie Willems-Van Dyke, talking about that decision.
If you look at our death data around who has perished from this disease, it is disproportionately people in older age groups. And the reason we went ahead before everything was tidied up is because people are dying from COVID-19.
And Nicole, you've written about that being a pretty good priority, that seniors being at most at risk should logically be among the first vaccinated. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, for sure. So the CDC, you know, issued some guidelines, which many states are following. Initially, they were thinking about kind of putting older people much lower down on the list than they did. And I wrote this op-ed, and some other people wrote op-eds, you know, and things to say, hey, you know, we tend not to prioritize the most needy. And it's clearly the elderly in this case. So if you're, you know, a healthy 20-year-old, your chance of dying from COVID is like driving 7,500 miles in the U.S. If you are 70 or 80, your chance of dying is like climbing Mount Everest. So if you care about saving the greatest number of lives, it's pretty clear you ought to focus on helping people who are older. And so that's what I was advocating for. And I think that came some way towards that conclusion. So they have prioritized healthcare personnel, residents of long-term care facilities first, but then everyone who's 75 or older and frontline essential health workers. And then they're supposed to go to 65 or older and people with high-risk medical conditions and other essential workers. But there's a lot of people in that essential worker category. And you know, I think there's still room for, you know, wiggle debate, I guess, about, you know, do you want to prioritize teachers over the elderly and this kind of thing? But states are doing it different ways. You know, I think what's really, really sad is when people aren't able to exercise kind of common sense and get as many vaccines into people's arms as possible, even if it might not be exactly the right priority. Because if you see those vaccines going to waste, it's, you know, a life that could have been saved.
Right. I've seen reports in some communities, I think including New York City, that, okay, we've got these vaccines. We're trying to get into the priority groups. If we have a batch of 30 that it's use them or lose them by midnight or whatever, they put out the word and say, hey, get over here, stand in line. We might have a vaccine for you, whatever group you're in. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's much better that it's not perfectly equitable, that we get it into somebody's arm, but rather than let it go to waste. I mean, in New York, I think the governor, it took a few days to kind of get that message that, you know, when they couldn't get it out to people, you shouldn't kind of penalize them for giving it to a different group. I mean, of course, we don't want people, you know, manipulating the process and jumping in line, because if you go ahead and get it and you're a healthy 25-year-old or a 40-year-old and, you know, your neighbor isn't necessarily going to get it for a, you know, few months, and that could be very dangerous if they're much older, for instance.
We're talking about the ethics of vaccines and the COVID-19 vaccine priority lists we've seen at the federal and state levels and internationally, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts? Are there groups you think should be prioritized? We've heard the case for grocery workers lately in Wisconsin, in contact with a lot of people. Deb writes on the Ideas Network Facebook page, grocery workers should get prioritized. Our guest just mentioned teachers as a possibility. Who do you want to see getting the limited supply of vaccines next? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with medical ethicist Nicole Hassoun about how to decide who gets the COVID vaccine next, what the priorities should be. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page with your thoughts. Let's talk about some other priorities, Nicole. One is stopping transmission of the disease. Where are people most likely to catch it and get it to each other? In the case of a senior home, you've got both of those, the people most at risk and the most at risk of spread at the same time. What other things does transmission do when we weigh that as part of our vaccine priority?
Yeah, I mean, it's for sure something that we need to focus on. So if you can find someone who's a super spreader, if it's a young person who's going to a lot of parties, or, you know, someone who's coming into contact with a lot of people at work because they have to be a frontline essential health worker, and you can vaccinate that person, you potentially prevent a lot of infections. And so saving the most lives, if even if that's your objective, may mean that you need to focus on halting transmission in some populations. And certainly those congregate care settings and, you know, essential workers are prioritized partly for that reason. But also, you know, for healthcare workers, partly out of reciprocity, right? These are the people not only that we need, but who are risking their lives every day to provide really important services. I mean, I think food workers too, people at grocery stores who have to be there so people can eat. You know, we tend to think of you know, healthcare workers only, but I think that these are some of the considerations that go into that prioritization.
We're having trouble with our phone lines if you're trying to call in, so bear with us. Hopefully we can get you in before the conversation is done. We did hear from Tim in La Crosse, who says we've known about the vaccines we're using for 6 months. He thinks we should be more on the ball and get them approved faster and into production and into our arms faster, basically, Nicole. And actually, yes, some of the early breakthroughs happened really early last year, of ones that ultimately got approved. What are the risks, though, of hurrying that approval process?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important that we get data on safety of the vaccines through, you know, phase three trials. And so it is true that, like, some countries have already approved vaccines that are not approved here, like the Oxford vaccine has been approved in the UK. The studies or whatever I've seen have suggested that there's some problems with that, and that's why the vaccine's not expected to be approved to April, as they've kind of expanded testing. I think it is important that we get access as many, you know, good vaccines that are being manufactured as possible. But really, I think the fundamental problem is that we, you know, didn't collaborate more in trying to do the research and development on these vaccines to get them developed more quickly, approved, you know, more quickly. And then when they are approved, I think they should be put in the public domain so that anybody can manufacture them, because 80% of our manufacturing capacity is in generics. And as companies, you know, who have to create deals and buy up the manufacturing supply, that just raises costs, delays things, and so forth. So personally, I'd rather see that, you know, we had kind of done both the research and development and distribution side a little bit differently, with larger public investments and expanding that capacity, because I think we should be vaccinating everyone against a host of diseases as well as COVID, you know, regularly. So I think it would have been a wise investment in the long term.
Now, with medications and research, people will point toward the value of having drug companies involved. They have the profit motive to work quickly. In this case, they also had some incentives, some subsidies, pretty big ones from the U.S. government. If they had to do their vaccine in the public domain, do you worry that that would be a disincentive to go through with it?
Yeah. Well, so I think what we should have done is all on this purchaser side, collaborated through COVAX to buy up the supply together and distribute it equitably. And rather than competing, as you're saying, with countries for access to the vaccine, where Pfizer's like, no, I'm getting a more lucrative deal over here or something, and I'm not going to be able to fulfill my contract or whatever. I think that we could have, you know, some companies agree to make the vaccines available at very, very low prices, right? They've taken a no profit in a pandemic kind of pledge. And of course, that might constrain some companies' willingness to work on that at all. But what we can do is reward their investments through the same kind of advanced market commitments or agreements to, you know, pay them should the vaccine be developed, but then allow that manufacturer to be done, you know, at cost and with generic competition. And I think that would have, you know, does Pfizer really need to make $40 for every vaccine it administers globally? Is that really necessary to recoup the research and development costs? I don't buy it, I guess.
We're talking to Nicole Hassoun, professor of philosophy at Binghamton University. She looks at medical ethics. We're talking about the ethics of vaccine distribution priorities, who gets the vaccine first and next and so on. Nicole, we talked about the priority, obviously, of saving lives, of stopping transmission, of protecting different groups of workers. What about other priorities, like if a country decides, hey, the thing we really need to do is, say, get kids back into in-person schooling as much as we can? Mm-hmm. How much weight can we put on something like that to focus on, you know, teachers and school staff then?
Right. I mean, I think kids have a human right to education. I think when we're talking about something like that, that's the reason, right? It's not necessarily for the teachers, that it becomes so important to help those teachers get vaccinated, but that, you know, kids are vulnerable people too. And I think their interests were neglected because they don't have a vote. They don't have like the economic pull and things that people in other groups have. So at least in many communities, it's exacerbating inequality in education and access. And for those reasons, I think those are very serious concerns as well. So, yeah.
Now, we've got a new administration as of noon Eastern time today. From what you've heard from the Biden administration, they're talking a lot about trying to ramp up a vaccine production and distribution. What kind of things are you hoping to see from the Biden administration?
Yeah, I mean, my one wish is that we will join COVAX and support putting basic health systems in place globally so that we can vaccinate people in poor countries as well as rich ones. I think it shouldn't be years before people can access a vaccine just because they happen to be born in a poor country. Some countries right now, I think they have 25 vaccines in the whole country. And I don't think that's fair. So yeah, I wish that we could join COVAX, support the global initiative. I think it's wise as a way to prepare for other pandemics and ensure equitable distribution, not only here, but everywhere.
Along those lines, in addition to the COVAX initiative, what kind of lessons are you hoping we learn for the next potential pandemic, whenever that might hit us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we should really take proactive steps to revisit how we're doing that pharmaceutical research and development. And so I've written a little bit about some laws that we might change. So there's the Orphan Drug Act, for instance, that President Reagan signed into law in 1983. And it basically gives companies credits for producing drugs that work for patients that don't have diseases that are major killers in the U.S. So if it's less than 200,000 people in the U.S., then they can get a bunch of tax credits and other lucrative rewards for doing research on these diseases. And some of the drugs like remdesivir that we've had out for COVID were initially, kind of using this Orphan Drug Act to make money. And they often end up being very expensive. And the orphan drugs are, you know, there's a bunch of ways that companies have come to manipulate the law. And I think that there's things that we can do to try out rewarding companies based on the health impacts of their technology. That is the number of lives they save, the amount of disability they alleviate. Because right now, pharmaceutical companies have the reason to focus most on, you know, chronic diseases of rich patients. And what we should be doing is doing research on sort of some of the worst killers that potentially pose the greatest threats to humanity, and then getting drugs available and out there at low cost. And I think the orphan drug incentives for pharmaceutical companies are very lucrative and potentially ways of rewarding them for doing research on major global health problems if we tie those rewards more to the health impacts of the technologies. And that could kind of fix some of the problems with that law. So I think there's ways we can make, you know, moderate, I guess, steps forward, as well as more transformative changes, looking to create more binding agreements to have, you know, initiatives like COVAX in the future that are adequately funded. And it's just like OPEC, you know, if OPEC, all the countries agree, you know, we're going to sell our oil at a certain price, people have to buy it at that price. If all the countries agree, we're going to create research and development and we're going to reward you at a certain price, then the pharmaceutical companies will have to accept that price. And of course, you want the price to be sufficient to get you the research and development that you need, but then you want it to be tied to the health impacts of the technologies, not to just how much of a product companies can sell to rich patients.
We'll leave it there. Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Nicole Hassoun from Binghamton University in New York, professor of philosophy there. She focuses on medical ethics, and we've been talking about ethics and priorities when it comes to vaccine distribution for COVID-19. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there have been calls from both parties for new regulations on big technology companies. We'll find out what changes could be in the works for Silicon Valley. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Today's inauguration changed the answer to a very specific trivia question about sports and politics. The question, what colleges have produced both a U.S. president and a Super Bowl winning NFL quarterback? Yesterday, there were four. Today, there are five. The University of Delaware is new on the list with President Joe Biden's inauguration. Joe Flacco, with the Super Bowl-winning Baltimore Ravens, was also a Delaware student. I saw this as a trivia question today. The only other one I could name was the University of Michigan, President Gerald Ford, quarterback Tom Brady. I'm hoping Brady does not get the chance to win another one this year. Michigan is also, as far as I know, the only college to produce a president, a Super Bowl-winning quarterback, and a Wisconsin public radio talk show host. I had to look up the other three. They are, according to various trivia sources, Stanford University, President Herbert Hoover, and quarterbacks, plural, John Elway and Jim Plunkett. Miami University, that's the one in Ohio, President Benjamin Harrison and quarterback Ben Roethlisberger. And rounding out the list, the U.S. Naval Academy with President Jimmy Carter and quarterback Roger Staubach. So impress your friends with your trivia knowledge. Win wagers. It's useful news for you here on Central Time.
Live from NPR News, I'm Jack Spear. Lady Gaga singing the national anthem on a cold, breezy but